This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Has the Vatican Bank really come under investigation? For money laundering? In Boston, did they just put a great big John Hancock on the economic recovery? And are they ever going to get all that snow cleared so everyone can make it back to work? Some answers to all those questions just ahead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by MassMutual, offering LifeBridge to help lower-income families protect their children's education at massmutual.com/LifeBridge.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us on this New Year's Eve. One more day ahead till we close the book on 2010. Can you imagine plowing every street in New York City? Actually, you had to imagine it ever since the big weekend snowstorm, because the street crews just now got around to finishing that mammoth job. Thousands of stranded air travelers were still being rebooked on flights home today. We know the storm buried New York under almost 2 feet of snow, but calculating the cost of all of it may take longer. The mayor's office says there's a rule of thumb that every inch of snow costs $1 million to clean up. It's harder still to figure how much the storm set back thousands of New York businesses, which had to close their doors or get by on short staff. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports.
When the snow falls, it's the temp agencies that get the call. At Bond Temps in Manhattan, the phone started ringing Monday morning at 6.
And it just rang all day long.
Nicole Kaufman says it was, by a long shot, her busiest day in 25 years.
We sent in receptionists, we sent in secretaries, we sent in administrative assistants. And some of these people, just a few of them, of course, are still there today, which is, that's a nice feeling, isn't it?
As for people that did not or still have not been able to get to work, some will lose vacation time, others get a snow day. Depends on your company. At the financial services firm R.R. Donnelly, Paul Lemma told me that human resources will make that decision.
They haven't made any decision yet, but no pun intended, we were able to weather the storm here.
By paying a lot of overtime to their skeleton crew and ordering in.
Pizza for everyone, sandwiches and Chinese food and sushi, those places were running in lower Manhattan.
And how about those restaurants? In hard-hit South Brooklyn, one owner of a diner had all his stranded waiters sleeping upstairs in a single bed. Then there was the lone Chinese restaurant that kept its doors open Monday after the blizzard on Sheepshead Bay Road.
There was just a ton of people inside the place. Yeah, it's a little takeout, New York takeout Chinese place.
Ned Burke is a blogger for Sheepshead Bites.
And I see this just one guy working the stove, and he was not answering the phone, which is ringing off the hook.
Further south, down in Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Here's a John Hancock that's too prominent to ignore. Some new owners just put their signature on a big real estate purchase, closing the deal for Boston's landmark Hancock office tower. This just might signal a return to normalcy for the commercial real estate market. Or at least it's a start. In some places. Here's Marketplace's Janet Babin.
The John Hancock Tower is to Boston what the Transamerica Pyramid is to San Francisco. Babson College real estate professor Michael Harity calls it an icon.
Well, the John Hancock Tower is the tallest building in Boston, a 60-story building with over 2 million square feet of space.
Boston Properties bought the lozenge-shaped glass tower for $930 million. That's about a third more than the sellers. Normandy Real Estate Partners and Five Mile Capital Partners bought it for at a foreclosure auction. Before the auction, the building was valued at more than $1 billion. Real estate partner Stephen Horowitz at the law firm Cleary Gottlieb says the John Hancock valuation was typical.
During the middle years of the decade, most people in the real estate market had drunk the Kool-Aid. Everybody was believing that values would continue to go up.
Horowitz says values didn't go up, and the owners at the time got saddled with too much debt. Real estate analyst Paul Adornato at BMO Capital Markets says that the sale happened at all signals a return to optimism.
Because what we saw really since the beginning of the financial crisis is that real estate transactions have essentially dried up.
But this was the sale of a landmark tower in a gateway city on the coast. The rest of the country may have to wait a bit longer for some real estate love. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
It seems concern about banking corruption has reached, quite literally, the highest levels. The Pope has set up a new watchdog to ensure the Vatican does not engage in money laundering or tax evasion. You heard that right. The action follows a criminal investigation into the activities of the secretive Vatican Bank. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The two top officials at the Vatican Bank are still under investigation for allegedly breaking anti-money laundering laws. The bank is accused of trying to transfer $30 million without explaining where the money had come from. John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter says the new watchdog unveiled today is aimed at repairing the Vatican's somewhat battered image.
I think the Vatican is attempting to assure the world, and in particularly financial oversight authorities in Europe, that it means to clean up its own act.
Just how much cleaning is required is not entirely clear. The bank, with estimated assets worth $5 billion, doesn't publish any accounts. Author David Yallop has been investigating the bank for almost 30 years. He says it's a haven for tax dodging and hiding the proceeds of crime.
I mean, the Vatican has been in the top 10 of money launderies, certainly as far back as my first involvement with them in the 80s and up to the current time.
The new watchdog will be run by a cardinal. The ultimate goal is to get the Vatican onto the so-called white list of countries seen to be cracking down on financial shenanigans. Jeffrey Robinson, author and expert on money laundering, is not impressed.
I suspect that the cardinal's orders are, make it look like we're doing what we should be doing, don't get caught again.
The church dismisses this as cynicism. A lawyer representing the bank said that setting up the new watchdog shows the Vatican does want to follow the rules. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
New concerns over the housing market weighed on Wall Street. Details when we do the numbers. We just noted, one of Wall Street's worry beads today carried the inscription mortgage rates. Interest on U.S. home loans climbed to a seven-month high this week. Of course, if you're an optimist, you can note that rates are still near record lows. Average interest on a 30-year fixed mortgage is around 4.86%. This comes after a survey showing prices keep falling. But Megan McArdle, a business writer at The Atlantic, says who cares? She bought a house anyway. Megan, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So the lousy numbers didn't get you down, huh? When did you buy your house?
We bought our house in October, and I did a sort of web video with Noam Scheiber of The New Republic, who had bought a foreclosure, and he sort of said, run, don't do it. But we went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah, let's look at why some economists aren't exactly sanguine about the housing market going forward. What's their rationale?
Well, you've got a bunch of factors. For one thing, you still have a lot of excess inventory on the market. The normal market inventory is about 2.5 million units. We now have about 4 million units. Beyond that, we have what's called the shadow inventory. These are the houses that haven't been actually officially put on the market, but which we know sort of have to be sold sometime soon. And then you have the foreclosures. We've read all of these magazine articles where people are staying in their house for a year or more, 18 months, after they've stopped making the payments until the bank finally gets around to foreclosing. But eventually that inventory has to be cleared, which means that there's going to be, for a long time, this downward pressure from supply. Meanwhile, demand isn't looking so good either.
So all that having been said, why in the world would you buy now? Why was this the right time for you?
You know, I was not someone who had ever thought I was going to have the urge to own a home, but I got evicted from my house in New York 3 years ago when they turned it into condos. And so I actually wanted that security of knowing that I own the house. As long as I make the payments, no one can take it away from me. I'd put quite a bit of work into my apartment in New York in terms of putting shelves up and all that. That all went away. And I was reluctant to do it again until I owned. Well, I wanted things like the appliances I want, the window treatments I want. I wanted something that I could customize to be the way that I wanted it, and my husband agreed. So we were ready in that sense, and we were ready financially. We had saved up a down payment. Maybe it would have been nice to buy when the market was further down. But the fact is, we're planning on staying in this house for a decade or more. And as long as we viewed this as what it is, it's a consumption decision. We were willing to pay and maybe even lose a little bit of money in order to consume housing the way we want it.
Let's look at this idea of investment versus buying a home for the long haul, as you say. We kind of got that backward during the boom. Do you think we as a nation have reversed that kind of thinking again?
I'm not sure. You know, when you look at how people expect house prices to eventually appreciate again, when you look at the rationales that are still offered by people like the National Association of Realtors, it's not clear to me that people have gotten the notion that you consume housing. It's not a durable investment good. It's not supposed to be the biggest part of your investment portfolio. Most people are still stretching to buy as much house as they can possibly afford because they think that that way they'll get the biggest return on their investment when the market finally recovers.
So given your experience, are you telling people that now is the time to buy?
I think the thing that people should really take away is that you have to think really carefully about this decision. It's not something that you should just do because everyone's doing it any more than you would jump off a bridge.
Megan McArdle is a business writer at The Atlantic.
Thank you very much.
There's an old saying, be careful what you wish for. Take, for instance, the declaration President Ronald Reagan made when he visited what was then West Germany.
Tear down this wall.
The wish soon came true, of course, and during the past year, Germans have been celebrating 20 years of unity. The remarriage has been expensive, though. At least $1.7 trillion has been spent in the formerly communist East, modernizing a dilapidated infrastructure and invigorating the economy. And after two decades, the euphoria has worn off. Kyle James looks at one city that's still struggling to remake itself.
This old newsreel praises factory workers in the East German towns of Wolfen and Bitterfeld. It doesn't mention that those workers were toiling in one of the dirtiest corners of Europe. The twin towns were the center of East Germany's chemical and mining industries. Environmental protection? Forget it. Resident Matthias Gabriel remembers sitting on a park bench one day in the 1960s.
Die Flecken sind nicht rausgegangen und nach drei Wochen waren es Löcher.
I got stains on my pants that wouldn't come out, and after a few weeks, they turned into holes. The place just stank. It was always foggy with chemical fumes. If you could imagine what hell looked like, that was it.
Bitterfeld and Wolfen were the epitome of a failed East Germany. Tens of thousands lost their jobs as uncompetitive factories were shuttered after the Berlin Wall fell. Almost half the population simply left. Today, town spokeswoman Katrin Kund walks up the ramp of the Bitterfeld Arch. It's a new steel sculpture with a 90-foot-high observation deck. From the top, instead of an industrial wasteland, you see a sparkling lake created from an old mining pit. There's a marina and several new restaurants.
I think we are a town which is the best example for the change. The change from a destroyed environment to a tourism attraction.
There's also a forest with biking trails next to a town that still has smokestacks, but that's largely been scrubbed clean of ash and soot.
We have a well-functioning environment, and we have a lot of tourists here, mm-hmm. But we have industry too, but it's clean industry.
A handful of solar companies have set up shop in the region. Konrad Zell works at one of them, Sovello. On the factory floor, robots attach frames to solar panels.
We have an industry and a branch that is proceeding at a pace you would not have imagined when the wall came down 20 years ago.
But real problems remain. The town's buildings might be renovated, but at 6 p.m., downtown is almost devoid of shoppers. There are concerns about the town's long-term economic outlook. Petr Wust is the mayor.
In these modern factories, you just don't need as many people. We'll never have as many industrial jobs here as we once did. It's just not going to happen.
Today, there are only about half the jobs there were in the 1980s. Unemployment remains high, and young people continue to leave. Like many towns in the former East, Bitterfeld is shrinking. Miriam Müller of Berlin's Free University says that's led to disillusionment.
In the smaller towns, you can somehow feel a kind of anger in the people. They feel disappointed by the politicians. What they had just expected from Western Germany was utopia.
What they got was capitalism. And even two decades later, many have still not come to terms with it. In Bitterfeld, Germany, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Coming up, cyclists are wheeling and dealing for a bigger share of the streets.
This is not like you got to be for the cars or you got to be for the bikes or you got to be for the buses. It's really not.
But first, let's do the numbers. The market soured as the year neared its close. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points or 0.1% to end at 11,569. The Nasdaq fell 3 points or 0.1% to finish at 2662. The S&P 500 chipped off 1 point or 0.1% to finish at 1257. Monster Worldwide fattened up 2% today. The employment agency's prospects rose after a Labor Department report said new jobless claims fell to their lowest level in more than 2 years last week. Anadarko Petroleum gushed up nearly 7%. A UK tabloid said today that BHP Billiton might offer $90 a share for the oil company. BHP picked up a tenth of 1%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up New Year's Eve. The New York Stock Exchange is open. Check your portfolio over coffee before champagne. It's party time in the city that never sleeps. About a million people are expected to pack Times Square to watch the ball drop. Planning your own shindig? Got loads of time? MarthaStewart.com has tips on recycling your leftover holiday paper into shimmering streamers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdahl. Old habits die hard. So guess which sold better this year? Compact cars and hybrids? Or were there more trucks and SUVs bought in the U.S. in 2010? Edmunds.com says it was the latter, but that might not necessarily mean consumers are gravitating toward bigger vehicles again. Edmunds reports a lot of those truck and SUV purchases were made by contractors who had put off buying new work vehicles. Alisa Roth tells us that's helped turn around the fortunes of U.S. automakers. She covers the industry for Marketplace and joins us from our New York Bureau. Greetings.
Hello.
What is the state of the auto industry now?
It's pretty good, but you really have to look at the context. 2009 was a disaster. I talked to Kurt Ludke. He follows the auto industry for a dealer broker firm in Connecticut, and this is how he put it.
sales are up from last year, but there's still, you know, really nothing to write home about.
So he's guessing car sales this year will be something more than 11 million, which is great compared to last year again. But until the financial crisis, annual sales were more like 16 to 17 million vehicles a year.
I'm guessing that there are some auto workers who are writing home about this. It's all relative, right? What happened to turn things around?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is the so-called pent-up demand. There were people who didn't buy cars during the financial crisis because they didn't have a job or they were worried about not having a job or whatever it was. And now they're going out and they're actually buying cars. So that's one thing. Another thing is that the big three are making cars that people really want to have. The Jeep Cherokee, which has been redesigned, has been selling well. The Ford Fiesta, which is a little small fuel-efficient car, that's been selling quite well. The other thing is that the car companies have really done what the industry calls right-sized. They've cut workers, they've closed factories. So what they're doing is they're making fewer cars, but they're making more profit, and they're selling more of the cars they're making at a profit. The other thing that's worth mentioning here is that with the bankruptcy, GM and Chrysler both got to wipe out all their bad debt and really just focus on restructuring and building cars.
Has this been uniform across Detroit's big three? How are the big three doing?
Pretty well, considering. GM, of course, had the IPO this year, which got a lot of attention. The company itself says it still needs to work on its European market, but it's doing pretty well. Ford has lots of great cars and great trucks that people really want to buy. And it's been cleaning up its balance sheet, which had, as you know, a huge amount of debt. And it's been paying that off. And Chrysler, which is sort of the question mark here, is also doing reasonably well. It's at a low point in its product cycle. That is that it doesn't have a lot of great vehicles to send out on the market right now. But some of the revamps, as we were just talking about, are selling well. And next year, it's going to start getting new cars from Italy, which a lot of people I've talked to have said, you know, should do well. Small, fuel-efficient European cars.
Well, let me put you on the spot then. Can we say the bailouts worked?
If the idea is that we needed to keep the auto industry going to save the economy or save this icon of the American economy or however you want to think about it, then yeah, it was a whopping success. If you felt from the get-go that the industry was not doing its job properly for years and shouldn't be rescued, then I guess not.
Well, one thing we do know, though, is that the auto industry does have a future in this country now. So let's look down the road. What does the future look like?
Well, it depends in some measure, at least, on how the economy does. If things continue to be slow or get worse, then we could see more trouble. Here's what Kirk Ludtke had to say about it.
You know, this is a large discretionary purchase. And so, you know, there's no guarantee that auto volumes are going to recover to what we think will be the new normal. But, you know, at this point, you know, we're starting to see some pretty consistent progress.
And he seems to think that things are going to continue to be pretty good. Car sales, he expects, are going to pick up next year and again the year after. It's just a question of what becomes that new normal, as he said.
Yeah, as we said, it's all relative, but I'll take that as good news, and I can use some. Marketplace's Elisa Roth, thank you.
You're welcome.
We come full circle now, back to the streets of New York City. The snow removal headaches we mentioned at the top of the program remind us just how important our city's streets are. And not just for cars. Municipal leaders across America are warming to the idea of bike lanes. They say riding more bicycles will ease congestion and cut pollution. But as New York is learning, introducing a new culture of bike commuting isn't a downhill coast. From WNYC, Andrea Bernstein reports.
It's hard to overstate how quickly New York's streets have changed since 2007. The Transportation Commissioner, Jeanette Sadiq Khan, touts the makeover every chance she gets.
We've put down 250 miles of on-street bike lanes in the last 3 years. We put down thousands of new bike racks to make it friendlier for people to get around by bike.
And the city just announced it's preparing to install a bike share program with 10,000 bicycles. In some communities, the commissioner is revered. Carol Coletta, president of CEOs for Cities, calls her a goddess.
She has made these transformations in New York with speed that would be breathtaking for a small startup, to say nothing of a bureaucracy like a city of this size.
But for some, the changes feel like a punch in the gut. One of those people is Marty Markowitz, the borough president of Brooklyn. Markowitz thinks the two-way bike lane along Prospect Park goes too far because it takes space away from cars and gives it to bikes. Here's how he describes the commissioner.
She is a zealot. She wants to make it hard for those that choose to own their automobiles. She wants to make it difficult, their life difficult. I really believe that.
For Markowitz, it's about defending mom-and-pop shops and middle-class workers who use their cars to get to work. But supporters have shouted back. And it turns out, one survey shows three-quarters of Brooklynites support that bike lane. But the controversy has gotten caught up with how New Yorkers feel about their mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who's known for his sweeping changes. At a recent city council hearing, Councilman Lou Fidler peppered the commissioner with questions.
You got to go back to communities and ask them again.
That's
before
what we
you
do.
Spend the money.
That's what
before
we do.
You do this. That's
Fidler concluded with a reference to the musical Oklahoma.
This is not a war. All right. This is not like you got to be for the cars or you got to be for the bikes or you got to be for the buses. It's really not.
Exactly.
All right. The cowmen and the farmers can be friends.
Maybe. Ernest Rossi runs a souvenir shop along one of the new Manhattan bike lanes.
So the way I look at it, probably almost half the parking space has been taken away from Grand Street.
Rossi says his business depends on tourists driving in. He doesn't get why the city wants to bring European-style bike lanes to New York.
And they said that, you know, they want the city to look like Copenhagen. They want it to look like, and this is Manhattan. It's Manhattan. It's not Copenhagen.
But for some New York businessmen, being able to attract international companies is key. Jana Lieber is president of World Trade Center Properties. He's overseeing the construction of 10 million square feet of office space to replace the Twin Towers. He says being able to bike to work is important to his tenants.
It also makes us more familiar and attractive to some of the European and international companies because otherwise people are going to go to lower cost locations.
Lieber says in New York, bike lanes have cachet with the creative class.
Well, because the kind of employees who bike, those are the kinds of workers that companies really want to have and they want to hold on to.
And Lieber says that's who will build New York's economy. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Andrea's story is part of the public radio reporting project, Transportation Nation.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, the Internet has turned the phrase you get what you pay for on its head, but maybe that's changing. A new survey from the Pew Internet and American Life Project finds two-thirds of adult web users in the U.S. have paid for access to video, news, or software tools such as word processing and spreadsheets. About a third surveyed say they've paid for digital music. The Pew researchers say it suggests paying for online content is not a completely foreign idea. So maybe you'll understand this shameless plug. There's always that contribution link at marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 15 points, or 0.1%. The Nasdaq fell 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 chipped off 1 point, 0.1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, calculating the cost of all that junk mail asking for money.
Just today, I received 66 address labels, 3 notepads, and a batch of Christmas gift tags.
I got the same thing. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.